Support for this segment and the following message provided by Freak Out and Carry On, a new podcast about politics through the lens of history. Hosted by journalist Ron Suskind and historian Heather Cox Richardson. Available wherever you get podcasts and on the WBUR Listen app.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, protesters at the G20 clashed with police in the streets of Hamburg, Germany yesterday. Here's CBS News' Margaret Brennan.
This demonstration is a smatter of anti-establishment, anti-capitalist protesters, and German authorities sent out 15,000 police to try to keep them under control.
President Trump says he's considering how to respond to North Korea's launch of a missile capable of reaching the United States.
I don't like to talk about what I have planned, but I have some pretty severe things that we're thinking about.
And Texas Senator Ted Cruz's 4th of July speech was interrupted by protesters upset by efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. Healthcare is a human right. Republicans got an earful this week. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kathy Gilsonen of The Atlantic, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. How is President Trump faring on the world stage this time around? What do you want him to say to President Putin? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Kathy Gilsonen, and she's senior editor of The Atlantic, where she covers, where she oversees the global section. Kathy, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Also from Washington, Naftali Ben-David joins us. He's Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to you, Naftali. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, always good to have you.
Hello, Anthony, Naftali, and Kathy.
So, everybody, as we go to air today, President Trump is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the Group of 20 summit meeting in Hamburg. This is a much-anticipated, long-awaited, much-anticipated meeting that comes amidst investigations here in the U.S. of Russian election hacking, possible involvement by the Trump campaign. Let me start with you, Kathy. What's at stake for these two leaders?
It's unclear exactly what they can accomplish in their meeting today. It's sort of a sideline meeting on the side of the G20. And reportedly, Putin and his advisors had been pushing for a bigger kind of meeting earlier. This meeting is reportedly only going to last for about half an hour, which when you factor in the time it takes for translators to do their jobs, means that there's little that can realistically get done. But on the other hand, there were reports ahead of this meeting that perhaps Trump was preparing a suite of possible concessions to use as bargaining chips, to include potentially offering to ease up on sanctions or return some diplomatic compounds that the Obama administration had taken away from the Russians in punishment for Russia's alleged election interference. I think probably what Putin wants is just to establish that he's a force to be reckoned with, and Trump is going to have to deal with him no matter what the anti-Russia feeling is in the United States.
Well, one of the big questions, of course, and one of the things that a lot of people are watching is just what Trump will say, if he will say it, and how forcefully he will say talk to Putin about Russian interference in the U.S. election. So here's President Trump during a news conference in Warsaw, Poland yesterday. He was asked about Russia's interference in last year's U.S. presidential election. Here's what he said.
I think it was Russia, but I think it was probably other people and or countries. And I see nothing wrong with that statement. Nobody really knows. Nobody really knows for sure.
So, Naftali Ben-David, what do you hear in that statement and what Trump might be bringing to the table with Putin?
Well, of course, he's made similar comments before, but what was striking about this one was to make it on the international stage so shortly before a meeting with Putin. And I think what it raises is that whatever substantively they accomplish, a lot's going to depend, I think, for President Trump on the body language, both literally and figuratively. In other words, people are going to be watching, given the Russia investigation back home, to see if he's soft on Putin, for lack of a better term, and if he comes off as being tough, somebody who can stand up to the Russian president. And he sort of sent mixed messages about that going in, because he did have that really hedging statement about Russian interference in the U.S. election, which, you know, let's be clear, the entire U.S. intelligence community believes that it happened and that Russia interfered with the attempt to help President Trump. On the other hand, in a speech in Poland yesterday, he did take a slightly harder line against Russia, mentioning destabilizing activity in Ukraine, supporting hostile regimes in Iran and Syria. So there's a little bit of mixed signals going in, but how his posture is, whatever happens substantively, how he comes off, I think is going to be very important to him going forward.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the president, what he said in Poland yesterday. He talked about radical Islamic terrorism and whether the West has the will to survive. Here he is talking yesterday.
The fundamental question of our time is whether the West has the will to survive. Do we have the confidence in our values to defend them at any cost? Do we have enough respect for our citizens to protect our borders? Do we have the desire and the courage to preserve our civilization in the face of those who would subvert and destroy it?
President Trump speaking in Warsaw, Poland yesterday in advance of the G2 summit in Hamburg, Germany today. Jack Beatty, what did you hear in that pretty lofty speech for Trump? Among other things, he celebrated traditions of free speech, free expression in that speech. What did you hear?
Yes, that was remarkable, given what he also said at that press conference, which is he went back to the fake news meme that he's been trotting out, which is a sort of defamation on the free press and an effort really to deny its vital role in democracy. So yes, it was good to hear him hit those high notes. However, if you start pushing at the speech, I mean, is it really the case that the, Western civilization is under existential threat? He said survive. Is that really the dimension of the threat? And then what are the things that are threatening it? Well, ISIS, yes. Radical Islamic terrorism, as he says, yes. And then somewhere in there, he mentioned government bureaucracy. And that kind of your heart fell there thinking, wait a minute, how is this such an ultimate threat to Western freedom? Nevertheless, to hear him even use the word values was a welcome change, it seems to me.
Big speech there. He's back to tweeting today. I'm going to read a couple of tweets. He tweeted out, "I will represent our country and will fight for its interests. Fake news media will never cover me accurately, but who cares? We will." Here's one more. "Everyone here is talking about why John Podesta refused to give the Democratic National Committee server to the FBI and the CIA. Disgraceful." So, Kathy Gilsonen, I mean, sort of, there's sort of two Trumps here. I mean, one speech with lofty rhetoric, big values being enunciated, but at the same time, he continues to tweet and be the President Trump present that side of President Trump that we're all very familiar with. What do you make of sort of the way he's presenting himself on the international stage this time around?
Well, I think when he made the speech was written presumably by a speechwriter and vetted by staff and touched on themes certainly that he has that he's articulated before in perhaps less formal settings. And I think that the tweeting, as you suggest, that is President Trump. That is President Trump. This is how he communicates. One thing a colleague of mine was joking about this morning is that it's hard to imagine the typical G20 small talk being about John Podesta and his refusal to give the DNC. So I don't know, did he have access to the DNC? Anyway, I'm very I tried not to spend too much time analyzing Trump's tweets. I did want to pick up on a point that Jack made about the threat to the perceived threat to Western civilization, which I think, given the context, given that he's delivering these remarks in Poland, which, as we know, is Russia's a big concern for Poland. I think how you define the threat is very interesting. So Trump clearly defines the threat to Western civilization as a combination of terrorism and bureaucracy. I think Europe would, and I think many of Trump's critics would define the threat to Western civilization as specifically Russian attempts to subvert the democratic process, and perhaps even Trump's own foreign policy that seems less committed to the Western alliance and or the types of values we talk about than previous presidents have.
Listeners, we're talking about a week in the news. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. At the moment, we're talking about President Trump in Europe. He's in Hamburg for the G20 meeting, a big G20 meeting. And Naftali Ben-David, I'd like to ask you about that because what's going to become of this meeting? I mean, there are big issues on the global stage here. Climate change, refugees are going to be sort of front and center. And the United States is going to be kind of an outlier with President Trump's sort of America First agenda. How do you see this meshing or not meshing?
Well, I think one of the really fascinating things about this particular meeting is that Angela Merkel and Donald Trump are emerging as the two sort of opposite poles, if you will, of the Western alliance on issues like climate, like immigration, like free trade. Repeatedly, there's a lot of European countries more or less on one side and the United States on the other, with Chancellor Merkel emerging as essentially the de facto leader of the other contingent. And so the U.S., of course, will always be perhaps the leader, certainly, a top leader of the Western alliance, but in kind of a different way, because you're really having this very different viewpoint being presented by the Europeans. And this is being hosted in Germany, in Hamburg, by Chancellor Merkel, so she has an even more visible role. The two leaders had a meeting this morning, which seemed to be relatively uneventful, near as we can tell. But I think what's going to emerge from this is this sense that the alliance, while united in many ways going forward, also really differs on many key issues in a way that we have not seen in a long time.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a big week in the news. You can join the conversation. Should the U.S. go it alone on North Korea? Is diplomacy still the way to go? What's the message for your senator on the health care bill? My guests this hour are Kathy Gilsonen of The Atlantic, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, and On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. And Jack, before we move on to North Korea, I just want to get your take on the G20 meeting. Naftali made just an interesting point before the break about how Merkel and Trump sort of representing these two poles at the G20. Trump also seems very much sort of out of step with so much of what is going on. For example, climate change. 19 developed economies expected to express support for the Paris Climate Accord, the U.S. underscoring its intention to withdraw. What do you make of sort of where the U.S. positions itself in this meeting of industrial nations?
Well, you could see a sort of passing of the baton of leadership of the West to Germany, which is historically a culmination of a vast change from the 20th century. And of course, in the area of trade, there is such a divergence. Just before the conference opened, Japan and the EU concluded a big bilateral, multilateral trade deal that's going to lower the cost it's essentially going to be very difficult for our farmers because it'll make it easier for Japan to be cheaper for Europe to send cheese and the like to Japan. And then on the other side, Mr. Trump is talking about steel tariffs and invoking what trade experts call a kind of nuclear option, saying that, our security is threatened by dumping of steel in America. Well, I'm sure there's some dumping going on. But as experts point out, this would hurt the European Union almost more than it would China, which has already begun to back away from that. And Europe has made clear, the EU, just in the past few days, if you do this with steel, watch out, Kentucky bourbon, you're going to pay a lot of them. It won't go into Europe. Watch out, Florida oranges. Well, they're not just picking things out of the air. Kentucky bourbon, Mitch McConnell, Florida oranges, Florida and its electoral votes. So this is a serious matter of our move toward what looks like protectionism at the very same time Europe is going further along globalization.
All right, let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Laura, good to have you.
One of the things, the most important thing that grabs me is the terrible network news coverage of the G20. I was flipping channels last night for the 11 o'clock news. only one channel even mentioned demonstrations, and they made it sound quickly in passing like there were demonstrations against the G20 meeting, not what the demonstrations were about. And America has failed woefully under Trump to meet our obligations in fighting climate change, which I really think is important. Another thing is his talking about American values. Where does he get off? His values are not American. He's leading a health care issue that goes all the way. It takes class warfare up another step. He's approaching genocide on what he's doing with health care.
All right, Laura, we take your point. I understand and respect where you're coming from. I think genocide might be a bit of an overstatement there, but we appreciate your call, and we're going to take up some of those issues in the minutes ahead. In the meantime, let's go to Josh, who's calling from Montreal. Josh, good to have you.
Yes, hi, Anthony. I was recently in Russia, and I've noticed that domestically speaking, I think Putin is in a commanding position. I mean, he's managed to really crush any opposition. He's going to be reelected, I guarantee you that, next year. And internationally, he's been doing amazing diplomatic dances with former foes like Turkey. He's courted America's close NATO ally in the Middle East, like Turkey. He's in a much stronger position than he's ever been since a long time. In other words, he was pushed around during the G20s previously, but he certainly is not going to be pushed around this time. So I think Trump is going to have a very challenging encounter with President Putin.
Josh, thanks for that. Kathy Gilson, and there's Josh talking about sounding like Putin might have the upper hand here. What do you think?
I think it's certainly possible. There were reports ahead of the meeting that that Trump hadn't prepared an agenda, and that, you know, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster had what I thought was a pretty telling quote about, there's no agenda. President Trump is just going to talk about what he wants to talk about, which to me sounds, again, sort of typical of Trump, right? There's not – it's more of a freewheeling style. I think the risk there is that Putin has less of a freewheeling style and has been known to take the measure of leaders that he's met with and is, you know, is characterized in the media as a master manipulator, which may be overblown, but the fact is that he does you know, he does study personalities. He does know how to push for leverage. And so I take the point also that that whereas Putin has been seemingly pushed around in previous G20 meetings, all in fact, you know, part of the anti-Russia feeling in the United States right now is indicative of the fact that Russia is considered a player, is considered to have influence on things like the American electoral system, like the future of NATO. And this is a position that I think Putin would welcome.
Hmm. Josh, thanks for that call. I want to move on and talk about North Korea, which launched an intercontinental ballistic missile this week capable of reaching Alaska. During a news conference in Warsaw, Poland yesterday, President Trump chided North Korea for this latest action.
It's a shame that they're behaving this way, but they are behaving in a very, very dangerous manner. And something will have to be done about it.
Something will have to be done about it. Naftali, what do you think can be done about it? And how do you think the Trump administration is responding so far?
Well, they're certainly talking tough, in some ways talking tougher than previous administrations, but it's hard to know what can be done. The dilemma remains what it is, which is that military action would be extremely volatile and dangerous thing to do, and it's not clear what else would have any impact. There are attempts to tighten sanctions, but they're already so tight, and Russia and China aren't necessarily going along with that. You know, one thing that occurs to me is one way to go is to try to step up U.S. military activity and presence in the Korean Peninsula, but the challenge there is China's not very happy about that. And on the one hand, we're trying to get China on board to help pressure North Korea. On the other hand, if we try to build up a little bit or conduct more joint exercises like we just did with South Korea, that is something that China and Russia don't like. So it's a very difficult balancing act. And despite all the very tough talk about severe things and something will have to be done and nothing's off the table, it's not really clear what that would be. It's the same dilemma that's faced presidents for many years now.
Indeed. Big dilemma. Well, at Wednesday's emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley called for a response to North Korea's missile launch that could hit the United States. Here's what she said.
yesterday's ICBM escalation requires an escalated diplomatic and economic response. Time is short. Action is required. The world is on notice. If we act together, we can still prevent a catastrophe, and we can rid the world of a grave threat.
Kathy Gilson, and I'd love to, for you to pick up on what Naftali was talking about. What options are available to the U.S. Beyond putting pressure on China, which the Trump administration has tried to do, and with tough talk like we just heard from Ambassador Haley?
Well, I think there are still additional options we can use. You know, there and in fact, in recent weeks, you've seen the Trump administration try to put more pressure on China, sanctioning a bank and two Chinese individuals for dealing with North Korea. So there is that lever to pull. You know, Chinese influence on North Korea is substantial. The question is whether or not, you know, the Chinese would argue, look, we can't flip a switch and get Kim to give up his nuclear program. And China, as Naftali mentions, has its own interests involved. You know, one of the things that makes this situation so maddening is the interlinkedness of each of these different possible options, where if you step up military exercises along Korea's coast, then you risk antagonizing China, which then will be less inclined to cooperate on cutting off trade. But there are additional sanctions that can be done. I mean, I think North Korea is less sanctioned than Cuba has been in the past. But the question is really how much influence that can have on a leader that has demonstrated just a total lack of concern for the poverty of his people. But then also the military options that are, quote unquote, always on the table, as Naftali suggests, are almost unthinkably horrible. So it's a tough one.
It's a tough one. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Mike, it's good to have you on the air.
Yeah, I had called about my concerns about the Korean Peninsula and the general hubris that we seem to have. You know, Trump in multiple measures, but our nation in general, we think we can run the world. Nobody ever has. It's always led to the downfall of dynasties. But yet, here we go again. And to me, it seems like even if you've got China, as Trump says, fully on board, to, you know, really ratchet down. They're the only ones that could. But, you know, if they really ratchet it down, from the North Korean perspective, what would that be? That would be an existential threat, just like a military attack, really. And that's what can push him into doing something really violent. I don't think that he is self-destructive. I think he's obsessed with unifying the Korean Peninsula. You push him too far either way, and that's when you really got troubles. Maybe we can't prevent him from getting nukes. You know, maybe we need to undermine him by exposing his nation to other things. But we can't run the world.
We can't run the world. Mike from Portland, Maine. Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Well, I was just going to say I want to join in the spirit of that. I shared President Trump's disgust at cable news just watching over the weekend. It wasn't fake news. It was fear news. Hmm. Broadcast after broadcast showed the trajectory, the missile, the projection, when it would hit, and all along. And what was missing, there were talking heads. They did talk about how the military option is not viable. But what was missing was three things. Current alternative to this, history and morality. Current alternative. The Chinese government has suggested, here is a solution. North Korea freezes its nuclear program right where it is and its missile program, and subject to international inspections a la Iran. And in return, the United States talks about ending exercises with South Korean military and beginning to withdraw some, if not all, of its military from Korea. Those are beginning positions that would accept the reality. History, you know, if we were having this discussion in the late 1940s, we'd be saying, Russia is going to get the bomb. We've got to stop Russia. This is a terrible event. We have lived with nuclear deterrence all that time. We could have had the discussion in the 50s about China. We have lived with nuclear deterrence all that time. And morality. Preventive war is an immoral doctrine. I am going to hit you because you might hit me tomorrow. You can't kill thousands, who knows, hundreds of thousands of people because of a sort of war in the subjunctive. It might happen. And there, I think Mike is right. This idea that somehow we rule the world, and by God, we're not going to allow even the we have lived with deterrence with these great powers. We can live with deterrence with North Korea.
Well, let's go to Paul, who's calling from Lake City, Iowa, with a question about North Korea. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Love your guys' show. I just have a question for the panel, and I think it kind of touches on what I've been hearing Jack talk about, actually, and that is that I wonder, as someone who's watched the escalations with North Korea throughout the 90s, if we don't overestimate their threat in this sense, that are they really attempting a form of extortion from wealthier nations, certainly principally China, their ally, but also Western nations, to sort of garner resources to sort of prop up their regime with the fear of escalation, and so that we sort of misunderstand their level of malevolence, and then on the other hand, the amount of calculation that the North Korean regime has with each escalation that they make.
Paul,
does that make sense?
Yeah, no, Paul, I think it's a great question. Kathy Gilson, do you want to respond to Paul's question, which I find intriguing and provocative?
Sure. I think that makes a ton of sense. I think there is a misperception in D.C. specifically that North Korea is unpredictable and crazy, when in fact you can see there is a pattern to these types of behaviors on the part of the Kim regime and that of his fathers before him, which is to say, you know, when Kim feels threatened, he lashes out. And in fact, you know, as Donald Trump was undertaking his sort of strategy review from the Obama administration era and saying, you know, the era of strategic patience is over, and using all this more bellicose language, that was the exact point at which you saw the ramp up in missile testing and nuclear testing. You know, I also take Jack's point that we've lived with it's, it bears noting also that North Korea hasn't tested a nuclear tipped ICBM. There's no evidence currently that it does have the capability to put a nuclear weapon on a nuclear warhead on an ICBM. It seems to be working toward that capability, but we have lived with the Soviet Union having nuclear tipped ICBMs. We have lived with China doing that. And so I think that North Korea's goals, you know, Kim Jong-un's goals are pretty much clearly stated in the North Korean constitution. You know, Kim Jong-un wants to reunite the Korean peninsula. I think in the shorter term, he wants to drive a wedge between the United States and its Asian allies as an interim step toward being able to reunite the Korean peninsula. But I would also say that deterrence goes both ways, right? Just as we're afraid of undertaking a military action that would end up result in the deaths of a lot of our allies and a lot of our people, you know, the Kim regime wants to sustain itself ultimately. And so that, too, would deter action on their part.
But if I could jump in.
Yeah, go ahead. We're up against a break, but we've got about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to say that there's still a tremendous amount unknown about that regime, unknown about what it would do. There's not a lot of interaction between the U.S. and that regime, unlike with Russia during the Cold War. And we're playing with enormous stakes. So I think that it's somewhat understandable that U.S. administrations are being very cautious in this area.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, a New York City police officer was gunned down in her vehicle in an attack that appeared to be unprovoked. And mystery solved? Maybe. A newly uncovered photograph could shed light on the disappearance of famed aviatrix Amelia Earhart 80 years ago.
Amelia Earhart, on a globe-girdling flight with navigator Fred Noonan, took off for a hop over trackless ocean wastes and was never heard from again.
I have a photograph which I believe clearly indicates that Earhart was captured by the Japanese.
And arts and crafts giant Hobby Lobby in hot water over ancient artifacts it tried to bring into the United States.
When you are buying looted antiquities, particularly from a conflict zone like Iraq or Syria, you are most likely aiding and abetting or allowing funds to most likely reach terrorist organizations like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda.
You can join the conversation. What are you hearing about the future of Obamacare? Have you heard from your member of Congress about this issue? My guests this hour are Kathy Gilsonen of The Atlantic, Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Thursday, in Salt Lake City, a group gathered to protest the Senate Republicans' health care bill. Tell Lee, tell Hatch, we are never going back. And I want to move on and talk about health care, specifically the stalled Republican Senate plan. As we know, Republican leader Mitch McConnell was unable to get the votes needed to pass that bill before the July 4th recess. So lawmakers headed home, and many of them got an earful, like we just heard out there in Salt Lake City. I'll start with you, Naftali. There are now 10 Republicans who say they won't support the bill in its current form. Can McConnell find the votes? How do you see this playing out?
Well, you know, there's really no public indication that any progress has been made over the recess. I think the hope of the Republican leadership was that senators would go home, things would quiet down a little bit, there'd be behind-the-scenes negotiations, and they'd be able to return next week with at least a plan for putting a revised bill on the floor. But, you know, Senator Hovind announced that he was a no, and no senator who had announced that they were a no has switched. So things are going, in a sense, in the wrong direction for them. And we'll see, but it doesn't look great. I mean, it's first of all, a vote's not going to happen next week. At the earliest, it would happen later than that. And so far, we're not seeing any indication in the form of deals being announced or proposals being submitted to the CBO, things that have to happen for the legislation to move forward. We're just not seeing any indication that they're any closer than they were when they left.
As we know, Mitch McConnell's in a tough situation here because he's got critics on the right who feel that the Senate bill doesn't go far enough. And he's got more moderate Republicans like Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins, who's concerned about specifically the number of folks on Medicaid that would take a hit. And here she is during a parade in Eastport, Maine. She says she's still a no vote on the health care plan, and lots of her constituents are supporting her with that position.
What I've been hearing the entire recess is people telling me to be strong, that they have a lot of concerns about the health care bill in the Senate. They want me to keep working on it, but they don't want me to support it in its current form.
Maine Senator Susan Collins there. So, Jack Beatty, how do you see this playing out? Mitch McConnell said if he can't get 50 votes, he'll have to work with Democrats to shore up the markets. I mean, is that a sincere suggestion that Republicans actually might negotiate here with Democrats?
Well, you know, it's ironic, given that for the past years, Mitch McConnell and other Republicans have been saying that Obamacare was irreparably damaged. Nothing could be done to fix it. Now he's talking about, quote, shoring up markets. This sounds like the kind of thing the Democrats have been saying for a good while, that Obamacare is, in fact, not in a death spiral. And it would take some shoring up of these insurance market in rural areas. But there you're talking about accepting it and making it work. And, you know, there are a lot of Democrats in the Senate who would vote for a realistic and patch to make this work. And this is in the pattern of American reform. Social Security passed 1935. 1939, it was all opened up again with all kinds because things were wrong. Things weren't working as people thought. There was something similar with Medicare, with changes all along. This is how social reform works in America. You get the data, you correct the program based on what you've learned. And essentially what McConnell is saying, maybe we'll have to do that.
What do you think, Kathy Gilsonen? Does this point toward the possibility that Democrats and Republicans might actually have an opportunity to come together over fixing Obamacare instead of tearing it apart?
It's funny that McConnell at one point was saying, you know, was talking about the consequences of this not passing. And the consequences that he cited were, look, if this doesn't work, then we're going to have to work with the Democrats. That was like the fear of what was going to have to happen. And I'd also point to the division not only among congressional Republicans, but between Donald Trump and congressional Republicans. You know, Trump has called the House bill mean. He's raised the possibility of doing repeal repeal first and then replace later, which is a non-starter in Congress, because people in Congress know that people don't want to lose their health care. So I think that Jack's point about the way social reform works in the United States, I think, is an interesting one, that it's sort of a software model, right? You introduce the software and then you work out the bugs as things stop working. So who knows? Maybe that's the direction we're headed in, but it's just such an uncertain situation right now.
You know, I was in New Hampshire earlier this week with Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan, who was visiting a rural health clinic about 50 miles northwest of Concord, New Hampshire. Now, not surprisingly, she went into a place where there was a lot of support for Obamacare and folks were opposed to the idea of tearing it apart. But what you heard was also huge concerns about the problems with the current system. I mean, people said, no, we don't want to tear Obamacare down. But when you ask them, well, how's it working? People complained about premiums that were too high, huge out-of-pocket expenses, huge administrative burdens that are driving doctors out of the system. The point being that whether you tear this system down or try to rebuild it, there's a huge amount of work still to be done. And it strikes me as a pity that, here we are at a point after months and months and months of trying to figure out what to do. We haven't spent any time actually talking seriously about how to fix Obamacare.
I think that's a fair point. And the challenge for the Republicans is that they are now in complete control of Washington.
Yeah.
And so whatever happens, even if it's just an extension of Obamacare to some degree, is laid at their doorstep. And they have this political challenge where if they pass something, that I think presents huge political peril. And if they don't, that also presents huge political peril. And so they're really caught sort of. This bill that they're putting forward is very, very unpopular at the moment, significantly more unpopular than Obamacare. And so if they pass it, that could have a real backlash. On the other hand, if they don't, after 7 years of talking about Obamacare as this abomination that needed to be torn out root and branch, I think that's dangerous for them and could cause a backlash among their base. So I think that in a way accounts for the very difficult situation that you're seeing them in, and their sort of mixed response and groping for some kind of solution.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call on this subject. Bruce is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Bruce. Good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. I wanted to talk about the recent approach of Republican senators as they try to sell the Republican health care plan by, in particular, not holding public town hall meetings. In Iowa, where I live, Senator Joni Ernst will no longer meet in public town halls. Recently, day before yesterday, she had an invitation-only sort of phone-based town hall, and she just fielded four questions in this town hall meeting, quote-unquote town hall meeting, and she used the questions really to sell the Republican health care bill. And after a ridiculously short town hall meeting, about, I'd say, 20 minutes, she suddenly ended it by going after the press as not being trustworthy in terms of its reporting on the Senate health care bill. And so I just wanted to ask the panel whether or not they think Ernst's approach represents a kind of calculated effort on the part of Republican senators to avoid public meetings, and whether it's part of Republican Party strategy. And maybe more specifically, how widespread is this approach? And do you think did the panelists find this a disturbing trend in terms of sort of our democratic approach, open meetings, and so on and so forth?
Interesting question. Naftali, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, I do, because, I mean, I think that the caller is correct. I mean, three of the 52 Republican senators held town hall meetings during this recess, and that's pretty unusual. One of them, for example, was Jerry Moran, who held a town hall meeting in this tiny town. It has less than 300 people. And the approach has certainly been that if you hold a public meeting, what's not unlikely to happen is, shouting matches and a very vociferous display of criticism for the Republican approach to health care. It does strike me as a little bit resembling what happened to the Democrats in 2009 and 2010. When they were trying to sell Obamacare, and there were similar town hall meetings where people, on the right side of the political spectrum showed up to often shout down their members of Congress. I think it's an unfortunate trend all around that a lot of these town hall meetings have become very much shouting matches and perhaps a lack of civil discourse. Not all of them, but certainly in some cases, and that the response of many lawmakers, in this case it's predominantly Republicans, has been to cancel those meetings. And so it really is hard to know exactly what the state of the debate is, because there's been so few occasions during this recess of constituents engaging and confronting the lawmakers.
I want to move on to a couple of other issues, but first I want to read a little bit of an update from the meeting between President Vladimir Putin and President Donald Trump. At his meeting today with Putin, President Donald Trump voiced optimism that there are very positive things in store for the United States and Russia. Bloomberg senior White House correspondent Margaret Taloff tweeted, "Trump and Putin did not answer shouted reporter questions about the 2016 election." So a little bit of an update there on that much anticipated meeting. Dear panelists, I want to move on and talk about the resignation this week of Walter Schaub, Jr. He was director of the Office of Government Ethics, and Schaub has taken on President Trump over his business holdings and potential conflicts of interest. And this week he quit, saying he's achieved all he can under current situations, current circumstances, excuse me. Here he is. We have a tape of him. Yesterday, Schaub spoke about his decision to resign. He told CBS News that unless President Trump eliminates all financial ties to his business, the American people will never be certain his policy decisions are in the best interests of the U.S. Here he is.
You can't be sure. And so it almost doesn't matter whether they are profiting or not. America should have the right to know what the motivations of its leaders are.
Now, the White House put out a statement saying the White House accepts Mr. Schaub's resignation and appreciates his service. The president will be nominating a successor soon. Kathy Gilson, what do you hear in this story about Schaub's resignation?
Well, I think he voices concerns that a lot of media commentators, for example, have had that given the financial entanglements, it's never quite clear whether Trump is working to advance his business or the United States interests, or to what extent he disentangles those two. I think also in the wake of the resignation, though, you know, Schaub may think that he's accomplished everything he can accomplish, but then, of course, the consequence is that Trump gets to leave his own mark on the agency now. And so Richard Painter, who was the ethics counsel for George W. Bush, called this a great loss and said he didn't think that anyone who came after Walter was going to challenge the White House publicly the way that Walter did. So we'll see.
Now, we should point out that President Trump handed over control of his private businesses to his sons. He's noted that there is no conflict of interest law that sort of governs the president. Trump's attorneys have said that he can't sell off his business because he'd lose tons and tons of money. Jack Beatty, what are you hearing in this story?
Well, this may have a sequel. I mean, attorneys general from how many states in the District of Columbia have sued the president on the grounds of that he's implicitly violating the Emoluments Clause. We haven't heard about that in a long time, but, you know, it's essentially what the ethics man was saying. You can't be sure. You can't be sure whether the decisions the president is making abroad are influenced by, having buildings in a foreign country, Turkey, for example, or having foreign diplomats patronize his hotels here. Are those influencing the president? Well, you can't know. And I think that's what the Emoluments Clause was all about. We don't want our presidents to essentially look upon their job as a way to enrich themselves, and that Trump was not under more pressure to divest himself, and to essentially get rid of all of this shadow. It bespeaks a kind of weakened political culture ethically. I mean, there was, you know, the Republican Party used to stand for integrity in office and say, no, you can't have, never mind the law, you can't be in conflict with the Constitution. But the pressure on that was just simply not there. And Mr. Trump continues to run his hotels and so on under this fig leaf that his sons are running things.
Naftali, we're up against a clock, but I did want to ask you before the hour is out. I wanted to ask you about some great reporting in the Wall Street Journal by Shane Harris, and this returns us to the issue of possible collusion by the Trump campaign into Russian election hacking. And Harris reported in your paper on a GOP operative, Peter Smith, who is no longer with us. He died after Harris interviewed him, who led an operation hoping to obtain Hillary Clinton's emails from hackers. It's a complicated story, but it brings the issue at least close to top Trump aides in the White House. Can you summarize what Shane Harris found here?
Yeah, I mean, what he reported is that this operative was seeking Hillary Clinton emails from various groups, including a couple that potentially had ties to Russia, and that he was implying that he was connected to Michael Flynn, who at that time was working for the campaign. So there's a lot of ifs, a lot of caveats, but the questions that this raises is whether or not there was some sort of a link, and that this operative was that link between some Russian groups and the Trump campaign.
All right. Well, it's a fascinating story. Panelists, it's been great having you. Naftali Ben-David, Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And Kathy Gilson, and senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the global section. Kathy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, great having you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Monday, are sanctions on China the way to send a message to North Korea? We'll hear the case for them and the pushback. Listeners, you can stay in touch. Download the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. You can follow me at Anthony G. Brooks. That's on Twitter at Anthony G. Brooks. I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.